Absolutely, Hans. And good morning, good afternoon, good evening, as applicable to everyone. And it's my pleasure. We are discussing primary financial statements again. It's agenda paper four, I think, in the pack you have. So the objective of what we are doing today is opportunity to clarify any outstanding questions you or your stakeholder might have on the proposals and the exposure draft, but primarily really for us to hear initial feedback you've been hearing from your jurisdictions. And for this session, we have prepared slides, but I think we are at a stage in the consultation period where you really don't need me telling you what the proposals are. So I wasn't going to do that today, but rather open for discussion topic by topic, I suggest. So the slides are grouped into four topics, starting with subtotals, then proposals on disaggregation, management performance measures, and finally proposals for the statement of cash flows. So I would suggest we have discussion on your question, comments, and initial views topic by topic. But before I open the floor for comments on the subtotals, I just want to thank those of you who have already arranged or are planning to have virtual meetings of various sorts in the environment that we are in. We already had a couple of virtual roundtables earlier this week with Standard Setter, which worked quite well, in my opinion. And I know several of you are either planning to do something similar or have already booked something similar. And I just want to reiterate that we as a team, and including our board advisors, are available for assistance, either by participating directly or helping you with preparings or debrief for those sessions. Also want to just thank you for your help with the field work, and that is progressing well, I think, particularly given the circumstances. And we are working closely with those of you engaged in that exercise. So with that, I just want to open then for discussion for your comments, questions, and initial feedback, starting with subtotals, proposals for subtotals in the statement of financial performance.
Okay. Linda.
Thank you. I just wanted to indicate before I start giving some of the feedback that we have seen still a lot of interest in this particular project. And we've been able to have some dialogue with our stakeholders through virtual means. And so the comments I will make throughout this are based on that outreach. We've had discussions with our user advisory committee. We also hosted a webinar in March, and we did polling questions during that webinar. And so that group would be a mixed group that included preparers, auditors, and users. We did get feedback from CPA Canada's small company advisory group, so that would represent smaller companies, the preparer view, and also from the corporate reporting users forum, so more users. So the feedback, I'll try to identify users versus others, but we are still gathering feedback, but we've already gotten a fair amount of feedback on this particular project. I would say the other thing that you should have from a contextual perspective is at the same time we're gathering this feedback, our securities regulators have published a proposed new rule on non-GAAP. And so we're actually trying to get folks to think about both of those documents at the same time, because there is an interaction, especially as we get to the discussion around management performance measures. So a lot of support. And surprisingly, Hans, a lot of support even from preparers in terms of this particular project. So in terms of the subtotals, because I know you want to do this by area, uniformly, the new subtotals, they think would help prepare a stronger foundation for people to do comparisons. But another comment that we got was that even for those non-GAAP measures that don't meet the qualifications of management performance measures, the new subtotals would give people a better starting point to do the reconciliations, whether the reconciliations are going to be in the financial statements are in the management commentary. So that was, and the small companies actually came up with that, as well as something they thought is a very favorable reaction to this proposal. They also talked about better alignment between the statement of profit and loss and the statement of cash flows, and that was spread both between users and preparers. And they and the small companies and the users from our user advisory committee thought that this would the subtotals would enhance comparabilities and comparability. And when we did the polling questions in our webinar, the response was 65% thought that the new subtotals would give better information to users. So a lot of support for the new subtotals. And the notion that you're directing the subtotals to get closer to the notion of an operating profit. So I would say that in most cases, I was surprised at the level of support even from preparers that we've talked to thus far.
Mm. Yeah, that is very encouraging indeed. Not sure if this will be the same in all parts of the world. Wonhee.
Thank you, Pai. Firstly, I'll speak as an AUSSG representative. We have one question about the scope for the distinction between integral and non-integral associates and joint ventures. It seems that the board's proposal is that an entity should classify associates and joint ventures as integral and non-integral when they are accounted for using the equity method. So does this mean that an entity should not split association joint ventures into integral and non-integral if the association joint ventures are accounted at cost or fair values? And if so, what would be the rationale for that? I think this issue can arise in the context of consolidated financial statements, but it would also be relevant in the context of separate financial statements. And as for general comments, AUSSG members generally supported the ISB's proposal for introducing subtotals and categories. However, most members were not supportive of the distinction between integral and non-integral associates in joint ventures. One member mentioned that investors do not show strong demand for the distinction. And the main concern about this split is that it would lead to an arbitrary classification. In determining whether an associate or joint venture is integral, judgment would be involved, and this would outweigh the benefits to users. And some users said, instead of this distinction, enhanced disclosures about association joint ventures could meet the users' needs. Even the one member who supported the split of integral and non-integral associates suggested that some key and commonly used indicators need to be provided to help make judgments. That's the overall comments about subtotals from AUSSG. And then I want to speak as a Korea CASB representative. I would like to make comments on operating profit and integral associates in joint ventures. Firstly, regarding operating profit and loss, Korean stakeholders are particularly interested in the proposed operating profit or loss because, as many of you are aware, Korean IFRS requires an entity to present operating profit or loss, and our operating profit loss is different from the proposal in the ED. We can understand why the board took the approach to define operating profit loss as residual income. We also agree that this approach has the advantage of improving comparability between entities. However, we are not sure whether the board's approach would actually lead to providing more relevant information, albeit comparability being enhanced. We do not think that the users just want comparable information. We think that they would expect to measure operating profit to predict how much an entity will generate income from its main operation for future periods. And we believe these users' need would be met when an operating profit loss represents only the results from the entity's main operation, while excluding the results from incidental activities. Take donations, for example. Arguably, donations as an expense has little relevance how much income the entity will generate from its main operation for future periods. So if donations are excluded from operating profit loss, we think that more relevant information would be provided. We do admit that comparability would be reduced to some extent if operating profit loss is defined as income and expense from the entity's main operation. But if we agree that providing relevant information is the first objective and improving comparability is secondary, our focus should be how to develop robust principles and sufficient guidance on what constitutes an entity's main operation in defining operating profit loss. Taking this approach, I think it is possible not to reduce comparability significantly. And this is our initial view, and this view is based on our experience with requiring operating profit or loss in our jurisdiction. I can say that our requirement has been functioning quite well because we have not encountered significant problems, although some application issues arise occasionally. So I believe it is more appropriate to take the direct approach to define operating profit loss rather than the indirect approach proposed in the ED. Having said that, we are still reaching out our stakeholders to hear their views and collect the comments. So we will keep our outreach activities. Regarding integral association joint ventures, as I mentioned, when I made a comment as an AOCG representative, we are not convinced of the proposal to introduce integral association joint venture category. First, it is not clear how an entity can determine when an associate or joint venture is integral or non-integral. As it stands, the ED does not provide sufficient guidance on that. For example, we find the examples provided in the ED not quite useful for financial institutions because those examples are based on the facts that mainly relate to typical manufacturing companies. Secondly, it does not seem that the benefits to users would outweigh the cost to preparers. From the users' feedback we have received so far, we have not found that users consider the separate information about integral associates to be highly useful. And preparers pointed out that arbitrary judgment would be involved in determining whether or not an associate or joint venture is integral. So I think it would be worthwhile for the board to reconsider this proposal. Thank you.
Okay, who's next? Chiara.
Yes, thank you. We have issued our draft comment letter the 24th of February, so we are already consulting on the proposals and organizing the outreach in this new webinar form, getting ready for the field test. We still welcome additional preparers to join our field test. With reference to the subtotals, we support this proposal. There was a consensus on supporting, in particular, the operating category, and more discussion about how to split the other elements between investing and financing. But in general, we support. I think we have expressed several reservations which could help to make these proposals more operable in practice. And many of these points have already been mentioned before me, so I will not repeat. Maybe something that was not mentioned is the fact that in European jurisdictions there are local requirements or for regulated sectors, requirements for the presentation. So there will be an interaction with those requirements. We haven't expressed a position on cash and cash equivalent and on time value of money because we had split views. So at this point, we are consulting our constituents on these. On integral and non-integral, this concept seems promising because this is an area where there is diversity in practice, but we would like to test the proposal during specifically during the field test to see how it is interpreted by the different preparers. We also identify an issue for entities that have to apply this split into category and have different segments operates in different industries. For example, a car manufacturer that also provides financing to customer. So it's not immediate to understand how the interplay between operating, financing, and investment would work in the same statement across the segments. And we also highlight perhaps the need for disclosure around the judgments applied to split the revenues and costs from intercompany transactions, from internal transactions used to split the segments, if the segments are split on the face. And this is, I think, all for the subtotals.
Okay. Anybody else?
Are we in the process at the moment of conducting our consultations? We've had some feedback from some of the PAFA members, but not every single person has come back just yet. What we have found so far, specifically on the subtotals and the disaggregation, is that that's been welcomed. I think where the project is going at the moment, that has been welcomed very much by the people that have commented. I think where we are finding that there are some issues that are coming up is there's been mentioned some inconsistencies between the current what is sitting in I7 on cash flow statements regarding classification. But I think as we get more detail on that, that will be sent through to the staff so they can have a look at it. There's also been some questions around how the materiality practice statement will interact with what is sitting in the current document. Again, we're waiting on some additional feedback on that, and that will be submitted, and whether or not XBRL has been considered as part of the process. But I think all of this talks to what we've got in the disaggregation. I think in this part of the world, we've had we've had some subtotals that we've generally used in the past that I think companies have put together, cobbled together themselves on the basis that the information made sense to them. And I think the fact that we now have a definition as to what the subtotals mean and what constitutes the subtotals will go a long way to making sure we've got some consistency to the way that the standards are applied. And that's it for me for now.
Nobu.
Yes, thank you. I have two general comments and one comment on subtotals. First of all, given the current circumstances, the ASBJ and constituents in our jurisdictions would like the ISB to consider extending the comment period. The second comment is that the proposals will lead to significant changes to the structure of the income statement, and we think global comparability is important in this sense, and therefore we would like the ISB to work with the FASB and other standard setters to the extent possible so that we can have a common structure of the income statement throughout the world. In terms of the subtotals, many entities in our jurisdictions are currently applying paragraph 85 of IS-1 in good faith and are presenting subtotals in their income statements. However, based on the proposed structure, these entities will no longer be able to present these subtotals, mainly because there will be unusual items that will be presented in the operating category. The subtotals presented in the income statement today may be presented as management performance measures, but they will be presented in the notes. And because an MPM can be a non-GAAP measure, we think the subtotals presented today will not be given the same prominence as they are given today. And accordingly, we question whether the proposals lead to improvements to the presentation of the income statement. Paragraph 85 of IS-1 is carried over as proposed paragraph 42 of IFRS-X. And we are concerned that this requirement, in addition to the three required subtotals and the disclosure of MPMs, will overcomplicate the income statement. Thank you.
Anybody else? No. Aida?
Thanks, Hans. I think somebody else was saying.
You, did you want to talk?
Yes.
Yes, please, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Aida. Actually, after the ED was issued by the ISB, we issued an invitation to comment in China in January. Currently, it's still open for comment. We will, the deadline is the end of May. I believe at that time we will have more comments from the Chinese stakeholders. Currently, based on based on what we received at present, we had several comments from preparers, auditors, and academics. Based on this comments, I would like to comment on the four questions raised in slide three. First one, on the subtotal, we have two comments. One is similar to two others already mentioned, that is integral and non-integral. People are, you know, the integral and the non-integral distinction sounds reasonable, but people are concerned that it may be very difficult to make the judgment in practice. People need judgment to make distinguishment between joint venture and associate first, and then they need to another judgment to distinguish integral and non-integral when preparing the statement of profit and loss. So, and these two kind of judgment may brought may bring the complexity for preparers. That's the first concern from the stakeholders. And they suggest if the board decided to go ahead with this approach, they need more guidance and criteria. For example, maybe sometime the joint venture or associate may change from integral period from the non-integral to integral. That might happen. So a criteria to make the judgment. People are concerned about this. And another point about the subtotal is regarding the operating, investing, and the financing category in the statement. People are concerned it might be difficult to make the judgment and are concerned that it might lead to practice diversity. And at the same time, these three categories are not in line with those in the statement of cash flow. Maybe some people might be confused about these two kind of categories. That's our two comments on the subtotal. On the second question in slide three, disaggregation, we just have some concern about the disclosure requirement for unusual income and expenses. It's very difficult and a challenge to develop a principle or guidance for identifying the unusual income and expenses. So the preliminary feedback suggested two options. One is to ask the board to provide more detailed guidance or examples to have people make the judgment. Another option is to ask the board just to provide a general principle in the standard, and each jurisdiction could define these items according to its local laws or regulations. That's our comments on disaggregation. The third one on the management performance measures. You know, we generally, you know, people's concern is the cost, the complexity, and a concern that the information is not verifiable to auditors. But generally, people think this kind of information is very useful. That's our comments on performance measures. And for the last one, the statement of cash flow, we generally agree the proposal in the ED. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Who else? Tommaso.
Thank you, Anne. We are trying this period of receiving inputs from our stakeholders, but we have difficulties, obviously. So as well as Nobu said, I think we would welcome additional time for responding and additional time for working on the field test. We have started sending instruction in liaison with the ISB staff to and the IFRAG staff to Italian entities, some, a sample of. I heard some comments of subtotals at this stage. I think that the three categories are welcome, but probably there might be some issues on separating the investing and financing and the issue related to the fact that operating is positively defined, but at the same time is a residual item. Another comment is that probably the four conglomerates may be difficult to present properly their business or separate into categories. On one other point that I heard is about integral and non-integral, which is something that probably may be operationally difficult to apply. But those are some first comments I received, and I really believe that after the field test is completed, we will have a better picture of it.
Okay. Any other comments? Nope, that's not the case. Aida?
Okay. Well, thank you for all that feedback. And generally, it is consistent with what we have been hearing in our own outreach and in the meetings we held or we joined you in as well. I will just use opportunity to just, I think there were a couple of questions asked in the process. I'll just try to clarify a few of those. The first question I heard is about why is there a distinction between associate and joint ventures measured at fair value or cost vis-a-vis those that are measured using equity method. So the whole integral, non-integral proposal came about because there was a view that some associate and joint ventures should be closer to the operating profit because they are integral to business activities, but the user pushed back on them being included in the operating profit because of equity method accounting being, you know, a single line that includes all income and expenses. We didn't hear similar concerns for associate and joint ventures measured using other methods, for example, fair value. So therefore, as you rightly pointed out, these proposals for integral, non-integral would not apply for those measured at fair value. Instead, what would happen is entity would make this assessment of whether it invests in associate and joint ventures in the course of its main business activity, the way, in similar way, it makes assessment for any other investments in the investing category. And if it does, this gives opportunity those entities, for example, investment entities, to move income and expense from all those associate and joint ventures into the operating, which is what some preparers want for all associate and joint ventures that are considered to be closely related to their business. But as I said, this is not proposed because of users' pushback on equity method messing up the margin analysis if being part of the operating profit. So that's I hope gives a little bit more color on the reasons why there is this apparent inconsistency there. I think we heard, and just kind of reiterate a proposal for operating profit and comments on, you know, why is this default category, why is this calculated as residual. But at the same time, we heard actually quite a lot of support for that, and particularly amongst users, and actually saying, well, this is the right way to do it, because by default, everything you and as a business do is operating, because you are in the business to do whatever your business is. And therefore, it makes sense that you actually just go by defining what is not operating. And by default, if this doesn't fall into these clearly defined non-operating categories, then it is operating. And actually, just a couple of days ago, we had a meeting with someone who likened this to equity. In a way, you know, nobody would argue equity is not important, but equity is also residual in the same way. So we have heard a kind of both sides of the stories. And I think in particular with users, they emphasize, they say, we like this approach that it doesn't exclude unusual items. It doesn't exclude any kind of things that companies might consider incidental, because it gives us a view of the stewardship of the entity. And, you know, we get information about future predictive value from the note on unusual items, but complete operating profit shares this complete picture of what management has spent in the period. So just because you are not planning to have restructuring charge or impairment in future period doesn't mean it hasn't happened in this period, and they want to see that. So this is some of the feedback we have been hearing about that. We had a question about XBRL and taxonomy, and I just want to use opportunity to share those of you who might not be familiar with it. We had, I think, 3 or 4 meetings already with our taxonomy consultative group discussing in detail working, and this is really worked by our taxonomy team in consultation with PFS team, working out how would proposals translate to taxonomy. And I have to tell you, some of that work, because this has begun long ago, has actually contributed to some of the proposals in the exposure draft, has helped us when developing examples. So we work very closely with the team. Not to say there is no issues to be resolved. We are still having discussions around how best to reflect, for example, proposals for management performance measures in taxonomy. But this is work that is very much on our radar, and it's very much progressed. So we are not waiting with that. So I think these are all the comments I had a star against. So I think that's all I wanted to say. So I would suggest that we move on to the next set of proposals and your comments on that. So disaggregation, and just to remind everyone, so disaggregation proposals include a suite of proposals, with including general and specific proposals. So general proposals, we have principles and guidance for disaggregation, as well as specific guidance how to deal with other items that might be immaterial. And then we have specific proposals, which include proposals for analysis of expenses by nature and function, where the board is proposing to strengthen existing requirements. And in here, we also have proposal for unusual income and expenses with the objective to provide information about income and expenses with limited predictive value. And we also have proposals for additional minimum line items that are not really, we haven't done comprehensive review of minimum line items in this project, but these proposals are really falling out of the proposals that we already have developed, such as, you know, Integral, and also our work on goodwill, and then the minimum line item for goodwill on the balance sheet. So with that, if I may open the discussion with your comments and feedback on this set of proposals.
Linda.
Thank you. We have some feedback on this area in particular. So I'll go first to the notion of the operating expenses being analyzed by nature or function. So the users were pretty clear that they had less interest in expenses by interest. They felt it was much more important to understand how they relate, how expenses relate to business function. And they said that analysis by function is critical. They also said they would care much more about fixed versus variable rather than necessarily see expenses by nature. It would be helpful context for you to know that in Canada, most companies actually tend to present a mixture, sort of a hybrid, where they give you some expenses by function and some expenses by nature. So I think we are dealing here with a resistance to a change in current practice. So we just have to keep that in the back of our minds, that it would be different information than they're used to getting. There was also some discussion from the smaller company perspective that given the way they do things today, that they would have some system challenges in adopting the proposals because they would have to change the way they collect information. They aren't saying they can't do it, and they didn't imply necessarily that the cost would exceed the benefit. But they did say they would have some system challenges. However, when we did our webinar and we asked a polling question with regard to the notion of cost versus benefit, less than half of the people responding said they thought the benefit would be more than the cost. So there are, I would say there's mixed views on this at this early stage in terms of by nature or by function. I think what's interesting to me is there was more interest in talking about the notion of unusual items. So in our regulatory environment, there's been a lot of work by the securities regulators to track the notion of referring to items as unusual items. And there's a general guidance out there that says 2 to 3 years, recurrence within 2 to 3 years would mean that it's not an unusual item. I think this probably is fairly consistent with the guidance you're suggesting around several future reporting periods. But the users came back and said they thought that those words were somewhat vague and may not be consistently applied. So there was a desire from the users to get clearer guidance on what would constitute usual or unusual, with the skeptical notion coming back from the user saying, well, income is always usual, but expenses are almost always unusual. And so that notion of trying to get some reliable information and consistent information was one of the main things that came out of this discussion.
Yes, Chiara?
Yes, thank you. Our feedback is consistent with what Linda was saying, perhaps because in some of our jurisdictions also there is a resistance to change it. Currently, there is a mix between by nature and by function. So that's why we are soliciting specific questions on this topic to our constituents. Then there is also a recommendation in our draft comment letter to clarify how these ban of mixed presentation combines with the requirement to present specific items separately from the rest, like, for example, paragraph 65 and B15. I think this is more for clarity in the drafting of the proposals. On unusual, we appreciate this definition, as we see that there is a lot of management performance measures which go around the identification of unusual. Of course, we had a lot of debate on whether unusual is non-recurring and whether it is exceptional and how the three concepts relate one with the other. So we had a lot of discussion during the preparation of the comments letter. And at the end, we suggest not to focus only on the fact that a given item may not arise for several future reporting periods. Because, for example, a typical process of restructuring may last several years, also in the future, but still being perceived as unusual. So we recommend to look into a less narrow definition of these items.
Hans, Patrick?
Yes. Patrick, yes?
By nature or by function.
There are pros and cons on the proposals, so we are expecting the outcome of our discussions. There is a tradition which seems to say that by nature is also interesting, and sometimes a mix of both is needed. I take the example of goodwill impairment. If you mix it into by function approach without disclosing it, you probably have a problem. As regards unusual, I would like to support what Chiara has been. We have the feeling that the current approach is too restrictive. And I think we are experiencing at the moment circumstances that might demonstrate that we need to find broader definitions in order to develop relevant information for stakeholders, investors, and other stakeholders. I am talking about the COVID-19 crisis, because I'm not sure that if we are applying the proposed definition, we would be able to meet the expectations in terms of information of investors and other stakeholders. So we should maybe test the situation, the current situation, with the definition. Thank you.
He wants to come in, I think.
Who else wanted to talk?
Juan, he and Jim have got their hands up.
Juan, he, I think, and Jim have both got their hands up, Hans.
Yeah, I cannot, my screen froze. Juan, he.
Okay, thank you, Hans. I will speak as a AUSS representative first. Regarding analysis of operating expenses, one member supported the proposal for the analysis of operating expenses, but a couple of issues were raised by other members. First, some members mentioned that it might be costly and onerous to disclose an analysis of expenses by nature, where the entity's most appropriate method is to report those expenses by function. They said that entities may struggle to track expenses by both nature and function. Secondly, some members pointed out that it is too restrictive if an entity is prohibited to present an analysis of operating expenses using a mixture of the methods of nature and function. One member told that it is common for companies to provide a mixed method of analysis in its jurisdiction. Regarding unusual income and expenses, members generally supported the proposal for the disclosure of unusual income and expenses. However, I also received some concerns. If I may highlight one concern, a couple of members were not comfortable with the proposed definition of unusual income and expenses, specifically the phrase several future annual reporting period or limited predictive value are highly subjective and need to be further clarified or tightened up. And now, as a CASB representative, I just want to make one suggestion regarding the unusual income and expenses. It appears that the ED requires an entity to disclose all unusual income and expenses across all categories. We'd like to suggest that the board consider limiting the disclosure of unusual income and expenses to the operating category. We think that unusual income and expenses that are not included in the operating category are less important. Also, it would be quite onerous for preparers to review all P&L items to determine whether they are unusual. Okay, thank you.
Jim.
Yeah, maybe very similar observations about nature and function, and we're also a part of our project is looking at whether or not we should require, if someone reports by nature, a functional breakdown. We do see, as many other jurisdictions, very often there's a combination of both, and at least in some constituents' mind, it's not always clear what's the difference between a nature and a function. For example, if I purchase component parts and report cost of goods sold, some would argue that is truly just a purchase cost, and cost of goods sold is a natural expense. Whereas if I manufacture cost of goods sold, I have utilities, I have overhead, I have labor. And so do I get a different answer depending on whether I manufacture or purchase? And so we've gotten into a high level of complexity of what would I do there, particularly given global supply chain and the ability to have component parts go in and out of someone's process multiple times during a cycle. So trying to figure out how would I split that. And then, as others have observed, there are types of expenses that even if you report by nature, some might want to see by function that some might want to see on a natural basis. For example, litigation settlement or impairment might be more useful to report the natural expense as opposed to try and functionalize where those expenses actually occur. So I think strong desire, at least as we reach out to constituents here, to continue to allow for both types of reporting within a single income statement. Then on unusual or infrequent items, certainly as we've looked at it, many of the same challenges, if you take the experience that we're going through today and look at a grocery chain or a retailer that might be selling certain types of supplies at volumes that they would have never expected. Is that unusual revenue? So my toilet paper sales have gone up exponentially. What portion of that is the unusual portion? Will that continue for multiple continuing reporting periods? So how would I make that assessment? Similarly, expenses, certainly what we're going through seems unusual to say the least, but many of the types of items that we're going to see, I think people might expect some ongoing component of for multiple continuing reporting periods, at least certain of the expenses. So I think would those, from an accounting standpoint, be considered not unusual, which I think we saw this even with, 9/11 here, sort of accounting conclusions that things that are highly unusual don't meet accounting definitions of unusual, and it sort of defies common sense for users of financial statements. Much of what we've heard then is, how does that really integrate with management commentary, which seems the best spot for management to describe the nature of changes of expenses, income, and is it really the case that predictive value is either highly predictive or not predictive, or does that really run the spectrum from things that are really highly predictive and other things that might be less predictive of the future, but investors probably don't look quite as clearly on a binary scale as we might try to sort out if we were to separate those two. So not sure the answer to that, but it's something we're really, really struggling with if we try to call that out, and then how will people know how to make those judgments?
Anthony.
Yeah, thank you. Just a couple of points. I think points have already been made, but just two things. One, it's not clear to me why there is this stress on the nature. Disclosing expense by nature is certainly given primacy in the ED. It's not clear to me why that arises, but. So I think in to an extent it kind of overstates the situation in talking about being either one or the other. In this CD, there are requirements to, even if you're using a by function, to separate certain things by nature. And it isn't really a very clearly binary approach, even in the ED, with certain items needing to be separately disclosed. Other things will be separately presented if they are significantly material to need separate disclosure. So I don't know, it feels to me like the debate between by nature and by function is binary, and some of the other recommendations in the ED. So perhaps we just need to pause a little bit on that and not be so gung-ho and just think about the provisions for information. In a similar way, on the unusual item, clearly any of these new requirements will need the application of judgment, and I'm very comfortable with that. But that judgment should be obviously driven by the principles or the objectives of the proposals. And I find this one a little bit confusing. So income and expenses with limited predictive value, yep, I get that, and that would take some judgment. But then to effectively say that if an item is going to happen in just one more period, then it must have predictive value seems to me wrong. So you could be doing a business restructuring and it's crossing over the year end. It isn't going to tell you anything of future. It is just a cost of this current restructuring. And so it has limited predictive value. But it wouldn't fall to be in this definition of unusual if any of the costs overran into the next accounting period. I think we should be aiming to achieve that objective of only calling unusual those income and expenses with limited predictive value. But I think at the moment the guide that's given is to restrict things with limited predictive value would not fall to be unusual, because that might be repeated in just one more period. So, to summarise, in general, I support what you're trying to achieve here. I just think at times it gets a little bit over-engineered and a little bit narrow, and we should just try and make sure that we're clear on what we're trying to achieve, and don't let the detail get in the way of what we're trying to achieve.
Who else? Nope. Okay. Aida?
Thank you. And thank you again for this feedback. It's, again, quite consistent with messages we've been hearing. And again, I will use the opportunity to just comment on a couple of things, sharing with you what we have heard and maybe explaining. And just like you highlighted the feedback on nature function, perhaps being too restrictive, and also feedback on unusual definition, perhaps being too restrictive, is something we have heard across the board. So on nature function, maybe just useful to just remind ourselves why has the board come up with this proposal at all? And I feel this works well when I use an example where users tell us that today it's very difficult for them to compare things like cost of sales, because they often find companies that would on face look to report by function, present cost of sales would also have a separate line item for something like depreciation. And clearly, to them, a part of that depreciation should be in that cost of sales, and therefore, and they don't know how much because there's no further disclosure about that. So that is makes it completely impossible for them to extract value from this cost of sales number and compare it potentially with the cost of sales that another company has presented that doesn't have depreciation as a separate line item. So this is a kind of case for that. But I think you're quite right in that although we say high level messages, there's no mixed approach, in practice, actually, the ED does have somewhat mixed approach because we say what the board has as the minimum line items, and these are largely things carried over from IAS 1, things like impairment of financial instruments and so on, they shall always be minimum line items regardless of nature function. So if you have reporting by function, you will still have your impairment of financial instruments separated out. So you have a mixed approach somewhat. And I just want to recognize the concerns. I think, Patrick, you mentioned that specifically, but also some of you others, and this has come through in EFRAG discussions as well, that, you know, this paragraph B15 we've been discussing so much, which is talking about items such as impairment of goodwill and litigation provisions and so on, that kind of puts them in the light of desirable presentation items, but not quite minimum line items. So this paragraph is not in the scope of this exception to nature function. However, I can really see valid arguments for maybe considering. So if we have impairment of financial instruments as a separate things that can always break nature function, why can't we have impairment of other things in a similar way? And I just want to share with you, I've started discussion with users in our outreach meetings as to what would their preferred approach be, and there is not a wholesale approach for all of B15 items to be in that scope, but certainly I think it's something we're going to have to look carefully and consider which, if any, of those items there should perhaps also be either elevated to minimum line items and therefore scoped out from the nature function, or do some other mechanism to enable entities to present those separately and therefore achieve overall better comparability for users. So maybe I encourage you in further outreach you do also maybe explore those specific items included there, and not just there, but in general, is there anything there that warrants being separated from that? And maybe just to finish on nature function, I often hear comments the board has given primacy to nature because regardless of your presentation on face, you have to do by nature. I wouldn't say so, because if the board did indeed give primacy to nature, the proposal would have been for everyone to present by nature on face. And this is actually what some users tell us to do, but this is not proposal in the exposure draft. So the view is that both methods are useful and you present what is most useful for your circumstances. And, you know, we did consider a proposal requiring reporting by function in the note for those that present analysis by nature, but it wasn't found that such approach could have benefits that exceed the costs, and it could even be misleading because if you don't manage your business by function, you know, this allocation by function could potentially be quite arbitrary and potentially also costly, and so therefore didn't feel like the benefits would be the same, whereas the nature, you generally have your underlying systems that gather your inputs, so although information might not be readily available, you would have inputs for that. So this is a nature function, and just a few words on unusual. We have heard comments just like you made today that from your stakeholders, the definition is seen as too narrow, restrictive, and often we heard examples of restructuring that goes over 2-3 years, and that ideally that should be in the scope. I want to share that users don't have same sentiment, at least not all users. Some have said similarly they might want to see more flexibility, but quite a lot of users we spoke to have said they are quite comfortable and happy with the decision being so narrow and just, I think, a few days. I think it was one of your consultative group user meetings that I attended. We had a user give an example of a company he was following for 20 years, and he said in every reporting period in those 20 years, this company singles out restructuring costs and describes them as unusual. And they were very happy to see kind of this being really, really tightened, because they argue, you know, you think it's going to be 3 years, who knows, you know, how can you be in position to tell us it's going to finish in 3 years? So they're comfortable with the narrow approach. And maybe just a comment on COVID-19. So we as a team have already started discussion and testing how would these proposals apply in this scenario, and we've also encouraged the companies that we are doing field work with to think about that as well as an input to the proposals. So with that, turn over to you for comments and discussion on the next topic, which is management performance measures.
All right. MPMs, Chiara.
Yes, thank you. And this is one of the topics where we spent most of our discussion time. In Europe, we start from the perspective of who, since 2016, has already put in place the ESMA requirements. So we understand that one of the advantages of having these proposals as part of the IFRS is to achieve a better comparability or level playing field with the other jurisdictions. However, when it comes to broadening the scope of the management performance measures outside the financial statements, the views were mixed, considering the practical consequences that this may have, including also the auditability and the costs related to this. So that's why we are consulting in our comment letter on a possible alternative definition of a narrower scope, which would be in one scenario limited only to where entities present the management performance measures in the financial statements, accompanied from also by the inclusion of this guidance, perhaps in the management commentary practice statement. And an alternative would be to have a broader scope of application, similar to what the ISB is proposing, but with a more clarified wording in the term public communication, which seemed to be very broad at a point where we also considered whether a tweet could be a possible communication where to look for potential MPMs. So the second approach would define the scope as the communications that are issued together with the annual report or equivalent interim reports, including the earnings announcements. So we are keen to see where our constituents will be for these two different possibilities. We suggest also to further articulate the linkage between the MPMs and the operating segments in IFRS 8. And then we have a question to the constituents on how do they perceive the number of MPMs following the introduction of these requirements, not only those on the MPM, but also a more structured approach to the definition of the primary financial statements. Could this lead to or incentivize to introduce new MPMs, for example, where entities would like to continue communicate in the same way as before? So we have a specific question on these to our constituents.
Yara, just on your first proposal, given that one of the objectives that the board has in terms of the proposals for disclosures of management MPMs is the sort of discipline around the numbers and making sure that it's clear to investors what's, you know, included and excluded from the MPMs, how would you reconcile that objective with an idea of only requiring that if they've chosen to put the numbers into the financial statements?
Well, you're right. Perhaps from a European perspective, we start from the assumption that we have already some discipline, and more will come with the enforcement during the years from the ESMA requirements. That's why when we, in the scenario where it's restricted to where the MPMs are in the financial statements, in the notes, we also recommend to extend the guidelines in the management commentary practice statement, because often, I mean, it's typically in the management commentary that we see the managerial view and the use of the MPMs. But I mean, this was really, there were two views. That's why we didn't take yet a position.
Linda.
Thanks very much, Hans. So this area was had a lot of interest in terms of our discussions with our stakeholders. I think part of that was because, as you all know, in late 2018, we published some non-authoritative guidance kind of in the general space of alternative performance measures from our framework for performance measures. And so there was a lot of interest in that, but also, as I mentioned early on, we now have our regulators out for comment with regard to a proposed new rule on non-GAAP. So there's a lot of interest in this area. So I have a lot of specific observations, which I will pass offline to the staff, but I wanted to give a couple of big picture observations. I think in general, the users are very supportive. They would, in fact, love you to broaden the scope of what you would call a management performance measure. And they all had their examples of, I'd like this to be included, I'd like that to be included. I think their motive for that, generally speaking, is that, you know, they're seeing the prevalence of information that they're relying on that comes from outside the financial statements. They like the idea of having it brought into the financial statements from the standpoint that they feel that regime will, you know, it will be audited. There'll be more discipline behind it. In our regime, because the companies have to certify their internal controls, they think generally there'd be better quality information the more you get into the financial statements. So there's that overlying kind of concept. The other one, though, that there was some concern about was the definition and what exactly gets scoped in and what isn't scoped in. I think, Kiara, that's consistent with some of the comments that you were making. So their notion was, if a company's, you know, how do you clearly define if it's in conjunction with the I4S results? And if they come up with new measures during a period, do you then incorporate those in the next period? And the users were concerned that companies would look at this definition differently, and so there'd be a lack of consistency about what was appearing in some financial statements and not in other financial statements. And so from a big picture perspective, we're going to explore that notion of how people would be interpreting the words in the scope of what would be a management performance measure to see if we can hone in and what we do about that. So we would expect that would be one of the main areas that we would look at. Now, the other specter is the auditors. We have been working with our auditing board here and getting them to look at the proposal, because there is some concern of whether, you know, this could be audited or not audited. And so we're also trying to get them to get engaged with us right now so that we could do some outreach on that. I would say, if you look at the overall tone, the users are very supportive of moving in this direction. The preparers are cautious about what this would mean in our jurisdiction because of our MD&A guidance from the securities regulators, and it's about trying to figure out the logistics between the two. But overall support, very supportive of the moving in this direction. Very supportive.
Okay. Won't he? Won't he?
Oh, sorry. Okay. As association representatives, I would say that AOC members raised a number of points with regard to MPMs. And it is mainly about the scope of the public communications. And as the ED does not limit the scope of public communications, questions can arise. For example, does public communications include informal or irregular materials, such as posts on social medias made by the company? What about the time frame of public communications? If a company uses MPMs only in the quarterly investor communications, does the company disclose such MPMs in its annual financial statements? So those are the questions raised by AOC members. And one member also questions whether the scope of MPMs covers those that are disclosed in the financial statements, because the ED only says about public communications outside the financial statements. Therefore, it would be necessary to include MPMs that are either presented inside or outside of financial statements. And as CASB representatives, I just want to make a point at a fundamental level. We are not sure whether requiring MPMs in the notes of the financial statements is within the role of IFRS standards, because public communications are outside of financial statements. The ED describes the role of the notes. The role of the notes is to provide further information to understand the items, including the primary financial statements, and supplement the primary financial statements. And in other words, the information in the notes only relate to the information in the primary financial statements. Therefore, we are not sure whether requiring the information in public communications, which is outside the financial statements, to be included in the notes is consistent with the role of the notes described in the ED. Thank you.
Anthony.
I understand those concerns just expressed about what is the role of the notes and whether reaching out to other public information really is the role of the financial statements or indeed the ISB. I kind of get those criticisms, but we do support what the ISB is trying to do here. I think it is clear that other information provided via MPMs can be undermining the relevance and credibility of the financial statements, and to try and bring some rigor into that, I think does fall within the broader scope of the ISB and its financial and standards for financial statements. I just wonder whether the balance is quite right in reaching out to all public information, and I just wonder whether that is actually practicable and achievable. I do think particularly the how auditable is that for an auditor to have to capture, analyze, and review every piece of information that the company has issued publicly. So I support, I think we support the sort of direction of travel, but perhaps this it's just slightly overreaching. Maybe something along the lines of limited it to information issued at the same time or within the annual reporting package, or one of those terms that we have, that the ISB have tried to explore in the past in setting boundaries for standards might be better. But I think beyond the financial statements is absolutely right. I think we need rigor on MPMs, which would otherwise undermine the financial statements, but practically, I think we might need to find a boundary which isn't quite so broad, all published public information.
Thank you, Anthony. Any other takers? No? All right, Aida, back to Aida.
Thank you. Thank you. And again, I'm glad I haven't heard any surprises here. So we have heard the comments you've made, and maybe again use opportunity just to comment on a couple of things. I think the point on that we have this range where we have users very supportive of the proposals and quite few of them, and some of you have noted saying, why didn't you go further? Why don't we have return on capital employed captured here? Why don't we have some cash flow measures captured here? Some have even gone as far as wanting operational measures. So, you know, I was at pains to explain how MPMs complement what the board has done in P&L, and it's quite hard to justify then how these measures actually relate to that. And that would be completely a different set proposal that could be considered, but quite different. And then we also heard, you know, there is still this some concern, is this the ISB's role? But I would say overall, the feedback we have been hearing across the board is support, because there is a recognition that the proposals will help, shine a light on this number, to use the expression Nick uses a lot in the outreach. I think maybe just to comment on the bits of definition, I think public communication is something that has received lots of attention, and you have mentioned that the definition of management performance measures says those used in public communication outside financial statements, and we had lots of feedback that this is maybe too broad and it could be unclear, and we had questions, does it include tweets and so not, how would this be audited in practice? We had opportunity already to discuss this with number of audit firms with their global kind of teams, and some of them are not concerned even with the proposals as they are. They say, well, this is a little bit more work for us. That means instead of just listening to press conferences and investor calls, we would have to do a transcript of those just to satisfy our procedures, but it is doable. Others, however, had concerns that this is really expanding scope so much, and they don't even know where to look at, because there could be so many different things there, and they were supportive of trying to narrow this down somewhat. So I use the opportunity to maybe discuss one of the proposals that you have in your draft comment letter, Chiara, about limiting it to communications in conjunction with reports. And we had feedback on that it's kind of, good direction, but that would give a lot of implementation questions, because, the timing issues, if something is issued 3 weeks before, 3 weeks later, how do you judge what is in conjunction and so on? So it will be a different kettle where we get constant interpretation questions, what is and what isn't in there. So just something to be considered as well as that. I think this is really it. I'm just going through. I think this is really the main comments and what we've been hearing so far. So with that, I think we have one more topic. So it's not one of our main topics, because proposals for statement of cash flows are targeted, but I think we have 10 minutes left. So just maybe leave the floor for those of you who have comments on that set of proposals.
Does anybody have comments?
Or maybe on anything else we haven't covered?
Chiara?
Yes, very briefly. We support the proposals on this area, but we have also expressed a recommendation that the ISB undertake a separate project on IAS 7 to have a comprehensive review of the challenges that arise in practice. For example, how representative is for financial institutions to have a statement of cash flows, or to provide guidance on supply chain financing arrangements. These were two areas that we identified. And also to provide consistency between the new contents and structure of the primary financial statements as resulting by this ED. Well, that's for
any
the future.
Other comments? Any other comments? Not the case. Well, that leads us to the end of our publication. I thank you all for your contributions. I think this last discussion was very helpful to the staff in further developing its proposals. So I hereby, I think over went pretty well, even though we had a virtual meeting. I think we were able to engage in a good discussion. So necessary can do this again in July, but that remains to be seen. Thank you so much. I hereby close the public session, and we will have a short private discussion later when we are no longer public.